Recorded Books and One Click Digital present Golden Sun by Pierce Brown. Narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
Once upon a time, a man came from the sky and killed my wife. Beside him now, I walk on a mountain that floats over our world. Snow falls, battlements of white stone and shimmering glass yawn out of the rock. Around us swirls a chaos of greed. All the great goals of Mars descend upon the Institute to lay claim to the best and brightest of our year. Their ships swarm the morning sky, cutting over a world of snow and smoking castles for Olympus, which I stormed only hours before. "Take a last look," he tells me, as we near his shuttle. "All that came before was but a whisper of our world. When you leave this mountain, all bonds are broken, all oaths dust. You are not prepared. No one ever is." Across the crowd I see Cassius with his father and siblings as they make their way to their shuttle. Their eyes burn at us over the white, and I remember the sound of his brother's heart as it beat its last. A rough hand with bony fingers lays claim to my shoulder, clutching possessively. Augustus stares at his enemies. "Bellonas do not forgive or forget. They are many, but they cannot harm you." His cold eyes peer down at me, his fresh prize. "For you belong to me, Darrow, and I protect what is mine." "As do I." "For 700 years my people have been enslaved without voice, without hope. Now I am their sword. And I do not forgive. I do not forget. So let him lead me onto his shuttle. Let him think he owns me. Let him welcome me into his house, so I might burn it down." But then, his daughter takes my hand, and I feel all the lies fall heavy on my shoulders. They say a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. They made no mention of the heart. Part 1. Bow. "Hic sunt leones. Here be lions. Nero au Augustus." Chapter 1. Warlords. My silence thunders. I stand on the bridge of my starship, arm broken and held in a gel cast, iron burns still raw on my neck. I'm bloody damn tired. My razor coils around my good right arm like a cold metal snake. Before me, space opens, vast and terrible. Small fragments of light prick the darkness, and primordial shadows move to block those stars on the fringes of my vision. Asteroids. They float slowly around my man of war, Quietus, as I search the blackness for my quarry. "Win," my master told me. "Win as my children cannot, and you will bring honor to the name Augustus. Win at the academy, and you earn yourself a fleet." He likes dramatic repetition. It suits most statesmen. He'd have me win for him, but I'd win for the red girl with a dream bigger than she ever could be. I'd win so that he dies, and her message burns across the ages. Small order. I'm 20. Tall and broad in the shoulders, my uniform all sable, now wrinkled. Hair long and eyes golden, bloodshot. Mustang once said, I have a sharp face with cheeks and nose seemingly carved from angry marble. I avoid mirrors myself. Better to forget the mask I wear, the mask that bears the angled scar of the golds who rule the worlds from Mercury to Pluto. I am of the peerless scarred, cruelest and brightest of all humankind, but I miss the kindest of them. The one who asked me to stay, as I bid her and Mars goodbye on her balcony almost a year ago. Mustang. I gave her a horse-crested gold ring as a parting gift, and she gave me a razor. Fitting. The taste of her tears grows stale in my memory. I've not heard from her since I left Mars. Worse, I've not heard from the Sons of Ares since I won at Mars's Institute more than 2 years ago. Dancer said he would contact me once I graduated, but I've been cast adrift among a sea of golden faces. This is so far from the future I imagined for myself as a boy. So far from the future I wanted to make for my people when I let the suns carve me. I thought I would change the worlds. What young fool doesn't? Instead, I've been swallowed by the machine of this vast empire as it rumbles inexorably on. At the Institute, they'd trained us to survive and conquer. Here at the Academy, they taught us war. Now they test our fluency. I lead a fleet of warships against other golds. We fight with dummy munitions and launch raiding parties from ship to ship in the way of gold astral combat. No reason to break a ship that costs the gross yearly output of 20 cities when you can send leechcraft packed with obsidians, golds and greys to seize her vital organs and make her your prize. Amid lessons of astral combat, our teachers hammered in the maxims of their race. Only the strong survive. Only the brilliant rule. And then they left and let us fend for ourselves, jumping asteroid to asteroid, searching for supplies, bases, hunting our fellow students, till only two fleets remain. I'm still playing games. This is just the deadliest yet. It's a trap, Roke says from my elbow. His hair is long, like mine, and his face soft as a woman's and placid as a philosopher's. Killing in space is different from killing on land. Roke is a prodigy at it. There's poetry to it, he says. Poetry to the motion of the spheres and the ships that sail between. His face fits with the blues who crew these vessels. Airy men and women who drift like wayward spirits through the metal halls, all logic and strict order. But it's not so elegant a trap as Carnus might think. He continues. He knows we're eager to end the game, so he will wait on the other side. Force us into a choke point and release his missiles. Tried and true since the dawn of time. Roke carefully points to the space between two huge asteroids, a narrow corridor we must travel if we wish to continue following Carnus's wounded ship. Everything's a damn trap. Tactus Au-Rath, rangy and careless, yawns. He leans his dangerous frame against the viewport and shoots a stim up his nose from the ring on his finger. He tosses the spent cartridge to the floor. Carnus knows he's lost. He's just torturing us, leading us on a little merry chase so we can't sleep. The selfish prick. You're such a little pixie, always yapping and whining. Victra Au Julii sneers from her place against the viewport. Her jagged hair hangs just past ears pierced with jade. Impetuous and cruel, but neither to a fault. She disdains makeup in favor of the scars she's earned through her 27 years. There are many. Her eyes are heavy, deeply set, her sensual mouth wide, with lips shaped to purr insults. She looks more like her famous mother than her younger half-sister, Antonia. but in her capacity for general mayhem, she far outstrips both.
"Traps mean nothing," she declares. "His fleet has been dashed. He has but one ship. We're seven. How about we just bust his mouth?"
"Darrow has seven," Roke reminds her.
"Your pardon?" she asks, annoyed at the correction.
"Seven of Darrow's ships remain. You call them ours. They are not ours. He is Primus."
"The Danzig poet strikes again. The point is the same, my goodman."
"That we should be rash instead of prudent?" Roke asks.
"That it is seven against one. It would be embarrassing to let this drag out any longer. So let's squish the Bellona thug like a cockroach with our sizable boot, fly back to base, take our just rewards from old Augustus, and go play."
She twists her heel for emphasis.
"Hear, hear," Tactus agrees. "My kingdom for a gram of demon dust."
"That's your fifth stim shot today, Tactus?" Roke asks.
"Yes, thank you for noticing, Mommy dearest. But I grow weary of this military crank. I believe I desire pearl clubs and copious amounts of respectable drugs."
"You're going to burn out." Tactus slaps his thigh.
"Live fast, die young. While you're a boring old raisin, I'll be a glorious memory of finer times and decadent days."
Roke shakes his head. "One day, my wayward friend, you're going to find someone you love who makes you laugh at the silly person you once were. You'll have children, you'll have an estate, and somehow you'll learn there are more important things than drugs and pinks."
"By Jove!"
Tactus stares at him in utter horror.
"That sounds resolutely miserable."
I peer at the tactical display, ignoring their banter. The quarry we chase is Carnus Aue Bellona, the older brother of my former friend Cassius Aue Bellona, and the boy I killed in the passage, Julian Aue Bellona. Of that curly-haired family, Cassius is the favourite son. Julian was the kindest. And Carnus? My broken arm stands testament. He's the monster they let out of their basement to kill things. Since the Institute, my celebrity has grown. So when the news reached the Violet Gossip Circuit that the Arch-Governor was finally sending me to further my studies, Carnus Aue Bellona and a few hand-picked cousins were dispatched by Cassius's mother to study as well. The family wants my heart on a plate. Quite literally. Only Augustus's badge holds them back. To attack me is to attack him. In the end, I could give a bloody piss about their vendetta or my master's blood feud with their house. I want the fleet so I can use it for the Sons of Ares. What a mess I could cause. I've made a study of supply lines, sensor stations, battle groups, data hubs, all the pressure points that might cause the society to stagger. "Darrow." Roke comes closer. "Guard your hubris. Remember, Pax. Pride kills." "I want it to be a trap," I tell Roke. "Let Carnus turn and face us." He tilts his head. "You've set your own trap for him."
"Now what makes you say that?"
"You might have told us. I could have..."
"Carnus falls today, brother. That is the simple fact of the matter."
"Of course. I only want to help. You know that."
"I know."
I stifle a yawn and let my eyes sweep the bridge pits behind and below me. Blues of many shades toil there, working the systems that run my ship. They speak more slowly than any other color, save obsidian, favoring digital communication. They are older than I, graduates of the midnight school, all. Beyond them, near the back of the bridge, gray marines and several obsidians stand sentinel. I clap Roke on the shoulder. It's time. Sailors, I call to the blues in the pit. Sharpen your wits. This is the final nail in the Bellona coffin. We put this bastard into the ether, and I promise the greatest gift in my power to give, a week of solid sleep. Prime? A few of the greys near the back of the bridge laugh. The blues just rap their knuckles on their instruments. I'd give half my substantial bank account, compliments of the Arch-Governor, to see one of those pale airbrains crack a smile. Enough delay, I announce. Gunners to positions. Roke, cluster the destroyers. Victra, attend targeting. Tactus, defence deployment. We're ending this now. I look over at my wispy helm blue. He stands central in the pit, beneath my command platform, amid 50 others. The snaking digitats that mark the blue's bald heads and spidery hands glow subtle shades of cerulean and silver as they sync with the ship's computers. Their eyes go distant, as optic nerves revert to the digital world. They speak only out of courtesy to us. Helmsman, engines to 60%. Aye, Dominus. He glances at the tactical display, a globular hollow floating above his head, voice like a machine. Mind, the concentration of metal in the asteroids presents difficulty in assessing spectra readings. We're a mite blind. A fleet could hide on the other side of the asteroids. He doesn't have a fleet. Into the breach, I say. The ship's engines rumble. I nod to Roke and say, Hic sunt leones. The words of our master, Nero Au Augustus, Arch-Governor of Mars, 13th of his name. My warlords echo the phrase. Here be lions. Chapter 2. The Breach. On the tactical readout, the six nimble destroyers move around my remaining man-of-war. Eerie silence from the blue crew as the functions of war take over. On the plane, through which their minds now drift, words are slower than icebergs. My lieutenants monitor my fleet. At any other time, they'd be on their personal destroyers or leading men in leechcraft, but at the moment of victory, I want my fellows near. Yet even when my lieutenants stand here at my side, I feel that separation, that deep gulf between their world and mine. Missile signatures, says the Comblue. The bridge does not burst into action. No warning lights panic the crew. No shouts break the stillness. Blues are icy specimens, raised from birth in communal sects that teach them to embrace logic and enact their function with cold efficiency. It's often said they're more computers than men. The dark space beyond my viewport blooms fresh with a thick veil of micro-explosions. Our flak bursts in a great screen of dull white clouds. Incoming missiles explode as the flak bursts detonate the missiles' payloads prematurely. One gets through, and a destroyer on our far wing ripples from the simulated nuclear blast. Men would pour from her. Gases would seep out. Explosions might puncture holes in the metal hull and bring burning oxygen rupturing forth like blood from a whale, only to be swallowed in a blink by the black. But this is a war game, and they do not give us real nukes. The deadliest weapons here are the students. Another ship falls victim as railgun salvos rip through the flak. Taro? Victra worries. I stand, absently thumbing the place Io's ring once graced. Victra turns to me. Taro, he's chewing us to pieces, if you haven't noticed. Lady has a point, Reap. Tactus echoes, face glowing blue from the tactical display. Whatever you have in store, don't be shy about it. Comms, tell Ripper and Talon squadrons to engage the enemy. I watch the tactical display as the squadrons I dispatched a half-hour prior sweep around either side of the asteroids and descend on Carnus's flank. From this distance, they are impossible to see with the naked eye, but they pulse gold on the display.
"Congratulations, my friend,"
Roke whispers before it is even done. There's a strange reverence in his voice, any earlier frustration now gone.
"With this, everything will change."
He touches my shoulder.
"Everything."
I watch my trap close, feeling the imminent victory drain the tension from my shoulders. The greys of my bridge take a step forward. Even the obsidians lean to watch the displays as Carnus's ship registers my squadron's signatures. He tries to flee, blasting his engines to escape what's coming, but the angles conspire against him. My squadrons loose missiles before Carnus can deploy a flak screen or bring his own missiles to bear. 30 simulated nuclear explosions rack his last ship. There's no point to capturing his ship at this point in the game, and so the blue fighter pilots relish a little overkill. And like that, I have won. My bridge erupts with shouts from greys and the orange technicians. The blues rap their knuckles vigorously. The obsidians, at odds with this high-tech world, make no sound. My personal valet, Theodora, smiles to her younger charges at the bridge's valet station. A former Rose courtesan, well past prime age, she's heard her fair share of secrets and serves as my social advisor. Across the ship, from engines to kitchens, the victory transmits through holo screens. This is not just my victory. Each man and woman shares it in their own way. That is the scheme of the society. To prosper, your superior must prosper. As I found a patron in Augustus, so must the low colours find their own in me. It breeds a loyalty of necessity to golds that the colour system itself cannot create by mere dictation. Now my star will rise, and all aboard will rise with it. Power and promise are celebrity in this culture. Not long ago, when the Arch-Governor announced he would sponsor my studies at the Academy, the HC channels blazed with speculation. Could someone so young, someone from such a piteous family, win? Look what I did at the Institute. I broke the game. I conquered the proctors, killed one, and bound the others like children. But was that a mere flash in the night? Now those prattling bastards have their answer.
Helmsman, set course for the Academy. We've laurels to claim,
I announced to cheers. Laurel. The word itself echoes through my past, making bitter my mouth. Despite my smile, I feel no great joy at this victory, just grim satisfaction.
One more step, Io. One more step forward.
Preta, Darrow, Au, Andromedus.
Tactus plays with the title.
The Bellona will shit themselves. I wonder if I can leverage this into a command, or do you think I must join your fleet? Can never tell. Gory damn bureaucracy is so tedious. Coppers to grease, golds to lobby. My brothers will want to throw us a party, naturally.
He nudges me.
At a brother's wrath party, even you might finally get bedded.
As if he'd touch your friends.
Victra squeezes my hand, fingers lingering as though she wore a gown instead of armour.
Loath as I am to say it, Antonia was right about you.
I feel Roke flinch, and remember the sound of Antonia cutting Leah's throat as she tried to lure me from hiding at the Institute. I had stayed in the shadows, listening to my small friend fall wetly to the mossy ground. Roke had loved Leah in his own fast way.
I've told you before not to mention your sister's name in our presence.
I say to Victra, her face souring at the curt dismissal. I turn back to Rogue.
As Praetor, I do believe I have authority to stock my fleet with personnel of my choosing. Perhaps we should bring back some old faces. Severo from Pluto, the Howlers from wherever the hell they got shipped off to, and maybe Quinn from Ganymede?
Rogue flushes in the cheeks at the mention of Quinn's name. Personally, I wish for Severo the most. Neither of us is particularly diligent at keeping in touch over the Holonet, especially me, because I haven't had access to it since the Academy began. Anyway, all he's partial to sending is holograms of uniquely perverted unicorns and video clips of him reading puns. Pluto, if anything, has made him stranger, and perhaps more lonely.
Dominus! The Helm Blue's voice draws me to the display.
What's wrong? I ask. His eyes are glazed. Distant, jacked into the ship's sensors, seeing the raw data of the display I stare at.
Not clear, Dominus. Sensor distortion. Ghosting.
On the large central display, the asteroids are there in blue. We're gold, enemies red. There should be none left. Yet, a red dot throbs there now. Roke and Victra walk toward it. Roke motions his hand, and the data transfer to his datapad. A smaller hollow globe floats in front of him. He enlarges the image and cycles through analytic filters.
Radiation, Victra hazards. Debris.
The asteroid's core could cause a mirror refraction from our signal, Roke says. Couldn't be software. It's gone. The red dot flickers away. But the tension has spread through the bridge. All stare at the display. Nothing. There's no one else out here except my ships and Carnus's defeated flagship, unless... Roke turns to me, face drawn, terrified.
Flee! He manages, just as the red signal burns back to life. Full power to engines! I roar. 30 degrees plus our midline. Launch remaining missiles at the surface of the asteroid.
Tactus commands. Too late. Victor gasps, and I see with my naked eyes what our instruments struggle to detect. One shadowed destroyer emerges from a hollow in the asteroid. A ship I thought we defeated 3 days ago. Its engines were off as it lay in wait. Its front half is torn and black from damage. Now its engines blast at full power, and its trajectory takes it directly toward my ship. It's going to ram us.
Evac suits and pods, I shout.
Someone's screaming for us to brace for impact. I rush to the side of the bridge where my command escape pod is built into the wall. It opens at my word. Tactus, Roke, and Victra sprint into its confines. I hold back, shouting at the Blues to hurry and unsink. For all their logic, they'll die for their ships. I range about the bridge, screaming at them to activate their escape hatch. The Helm Blue does, pressing a button that causes a hole to dilate in the floor of the pit. One by one, they unsink and are sucked down the gravity tube into their escape pods.
Theodora!
I shout, seeing her prying at a young Blue who still clutches his operations display with white-knuckled fear.
Get in that gory damn pod!
She doesn't listen, nor does the Blue let go. I start toward them just as the proximity sensor lets loose one final warning blast. All slows. Bridge lights throb red. I jump for Theodora, wrapping my arms around her, and the destroyer hits my man-of-war at her midline. Clutching Theodora to my chest, I'm thrown 30 meters across my bridge, slamming into a metal wall. White pain rips across my left arm along the seams of the mending break. I'm slapped with darkness. Lights dance there, first like stars, then as weaving lines of sand disturbed by wind. Red light seeps through my eyelids. A gentle hand pulls at my clothing.
I open my eyes. I'm wrapped around a dented electrical column as the ship shudders, groaning like an ancient dying beast sinking in the deep. The column trembles violently against my stomach as the destroyer finishes shearing through our middle, gutting us with slow cruelty. Someone's shouting my name. Sound fades back into being. Lights bathe the bridge, alternating shades of murderous red. Warning sirens. The ship's swan song. Theodora's delicate old hands pull at me, like a bird pulling at a fallen statue. I'm bleeding from my forehead. My nose is broken. I wipe the stinging blood from my eyes and roll onto my back. A broken display sparks beside me. It has my blood on it. Did it fall on me? A bar lies beside it, and my eyes drift to Theodora. She pried it off. But she's so small. Her hands cup my face.
Get up, Dominus! If you want to live, you have to get up!
The old woman's hands tremble from fear.
Please, get up!
Groaning, I pull myself to my feet. My command escape pod is gone. In the collision it must have launched, either that or they left me behind. So too has the blue escape pod jettisoned away. The frightened blue has become a stain on a bulkhead. Theodora can't tear her eyes away from the sight.
There's another pod in my quarters, I mutter.
Then I see why Theodora winces, not from fear, but pain. Her leg is shattered, splayed off to the side like a length of wet, cracked chalk. They don't make pinks to last through this.
I won't make it, Dominus. Go, now.
I bend to a knee and throw her over the shoulder of my good arm. She whimpers horribly as her leg shifts under her. I feel her teeth rattle, and I run. I run through the broken bridge toward the wound that is killing my ship, through the bridge level's hallways into a scene of chaos. People swarm the main halls, abandoning their posts and functions as they race to escape pods and the troop carriers in the forward hangar. People who fought for me. Electricians, janitors, soldiers, cooks, valets. They'll never make it to safety. Many change course when they see me. They tumble forward, leaning against me, panicked and crazed in their mania to find safety. They pull at me, screaming, pleading. I push them off, losing a small part of my heart as each falls behind. I can't save them. I can't. An orange grabs Theodora's good leg, and a grey sergeant hits him in the forehead till he drops like a stone to the ground.
Clear a path!
The thick grey bellows. She whips her scorcher out of her tactical holster and shoots it into the air. Another grey, remembering himself, or perhaps thinking I'm his ticket out of this death trap, joins her in parting the chaos. Soon, two more carve a path at gunpoint. With her help, I make it to my suite. The door hisses open at my DNA's touch and we move through. The greys back in after us, training their scorches at the 30 desperate souls who ring the entrance. The door hisses, as if to close, but an obsidian pushes through the crowd and jams herself into the doorframe, preventing the door from closing. An orange joins her, then a low-ranking blue. Without hesitation, the grey sergeant shoots the obsidian in the head. Her companions gun down the blue and orange and shove them off the doorframe so it can close. I tear my eyes away from the blood on the ground to lay Theodora on one of my couches.
Dominus, how much room is there in the escape pod?
The grey sergeant asks me as I head to the pod's entry lock. Her hair is buzzed in military fashion. A tattoo on her tan neck peeks from under her collar. My hands fly over the control prism, entering the password with a series of hand motions.
Four seats. You get two. Decide among yourselves.
There's six of us.
Two,
the female sergeant asks coldly.
But the pink's a slave.
One of the greys hisses.
Not worth shit, says another. She's my slave, I growl. Do as I say. Slag that.
Then I feel the silence as much as hear it, and I know one of them has pulled a gun on me. I turn, slowly. The stocky old grey is not a fool. He's backed out of my reach. I've no armour, only my razor. I might be able to kill him. The others ask what the hell he thinks he's doing.
I'm a free man, Dominus. I should get to go.
The grey says, voice trembling.
I have a family. It is my right to go.
He looks to his fellows, bathed in the nasty red of the emergency lights.
She's just a whore. A jumped-up whore.
Marcel, put the gun down, says the dark-skinned corporal. His eyes are heavy for his friend. Remember your vows. We'll draw lots.
It's not fair. She can't even have children.
And what would your children think of you now? I ask.
Marcel's eyes fill with tears. The scorcher quivers in his thick hand. Then a gunshot. His body stiffens and crumples lifelessly to the deck as the bullet from the sergeant's scorcher carries through his head to slam into the metal bulkhead.
We do it by rank, the sergeant says, holstering her weapon.
Were I still the man Io knew, I would have stood frozen in horror. But that man is gone. I mourn his passing every day, forgetting more and more of who I was, what dreams I held, what things I loved. The sadness now is numb. And I carry on despite the shadow it casts over me. The escape pod opens, magnetic lock thudding back. The door hisses upward. I pick Theodora from the couch and strap her into one of the seats. The straps are nearly too big, made for golds. Then something deep and horrible roars in the belly of my ship. Half a kilometre away, our torpedo stores detonate. Gone is the artificial gravity. Gone are the stable walls. It's an insidious sensation. Everything spins. I slam into the escape pod's floor. Ceiling? I don't know. Pressure vents out of the ship. Someone vomits. I smell it rather than hear it. I shout at the greys to get in the pod. Only one stays behind now, face drawn and quiet, as the sergeant and a corporal pull themselves into the escape pod. They strap in across from me. I activate the launch function and salute the grey who stays behind. He salutes back, proud and loyal, despite the quiet in him, as he faces his last moment of life. Eyes distant and thinking of some young love, some path not taken. Perhaps wondering why he was not born gold. Then the door closes, and he is gone from my world. I'm slammed into my seat as the escape pod shoots away from the dying ship, ripping through debris. Then we're weightless again, and drifting away from trouble as inertial dampeners kick in. Out our viewport, I see my flagship burping plumes of blue and red flame. Processed helium-3, which powers both ships, ignites near my man-of-war's engines, causing a chain-effect explosion that rips the ship apart. Suddenly, I realize it wasn't debris I felt against my escape pod as I left the ship. It was people. My crew. Hundreds of low-colours spilled into space. The greys sit opposite me.
He had three girls,
the dark-skinned corporal says, shuddering as the adrenaline fades away.
2 years and he was out with a pension. And you popped him in the head. After my report, coward won't even scrape a death pension,
the sergeant sneers. The corporal blinks at her.
You cold bitch.
Their words fade, overcome by the beating of blood in my ears. This is my fault. I broke the rules at the Institute. I changed the paradigm and thought they wouldn't adapt. That they wouldn't change their strategy for me. And now I've lost so many lives I may never know the tally. More people just died in a blink than during a whole year of the Institute. Their deaths opening a black hole in my stomach. Roke and Victra hail me over the comms. They will have tracked my datapad and know I'm safe. I barely hear them. Anger, thick and evil, swirls inside me, making my hands shake, my heart slam. Somehow, Karnas's ship continues through space after bisecting my command, damaged but not broken. I stand in my pod, unbuckling the seat's restraints. At the far end of the escape pod lies a spit tube with a preloaded star shell, a mechanized suit meant to make a man a human torpedo. It's designed to launch Golds to asteroids or planets because the pod wouldn't survive atmospheric re-entry. But I'll use it for vengeance. I launch myself onto that Bologna bastard's bloody damn bridge. Theodora has not yet woken. I'm glad. I tell the corporal to help me into the suit. 2 minutes later, I'm in the metal carapace. Takes another two to argue with the computer over the calculations required for my trajectory to intersect with Karnas's so that I can smash through the bridge windows. I've never heard of anyone doing this, never seen it even attempted. It's madness. But Karnas will pay. I start my own countdown. 3. The enemy ship passes arrogantly 100 kilometers away. It is like a dark snake with a blue tail, a bridge in place of eyes. Between us, 100 escape pods glimmer, so many rubies cast into the sun. 2. I pray that I will find the veil if I do not survive this. 1. My controls go dead, and red flashes across my helmet. The proctors override my computer and freeze my controls.
No!
I roar, watching Karnas's ship disappear into the black. Chapter 3. Blood and Piss. 833 men and women. 833 killed for a game. I wish I never knew the tally. I repeat the number again and again as I sit in the passenger hold of the rescue ship sent to ferry me back to the academy. My lieutenants sit, afraid to meet my gaze. Even Roke leaves me be. The instructors disabled my craft before I could launch. They say they did it to spare me a fool's mistake. The gambit was rash, stupid, and unfitting a Gold Praetor. I stared blankly at them as they debriefed me via holo. We reached the academy in the ebbing day hours of my ship's time cycle. The place is a great domed metal port on the fringes of an asteroid field, ringed with docks for destroyers and men of war. Most are filled. Home to the Academy and Mid-Sector Command, it is one of the hives of the Society's military for the mid-worlds of Mars, Jupiter, and Neptune, though it does serve other planetary forces when their orbits take them near. My fellow students will have been watching here in the dormitories. So, too, will have many fleet officials and peerless who flocked here for the final weeks of the game, for parties and viewing. None will mention the cost of life demanded by Karnas's victory, but the defeat will set back my mission. The Sons of Ares have spies. They have hackers and courtesans to steal secrets. What they did not have was a fleet. Nor will they, now. No one greets my lieutenants or me at the dock. Reds and browns bustle about to the orders of 2 violets and a copper, who make preparations for Karnas's victory in the grand antechamber. The blue and silver of House Bologna trim the cavernous metal halls. The eagle crest of his family covers the walls. They have white rose petals for him. Red rose petals are reserved for triumphs, true victories where gold blood is shed. The blood of 833 low colours doesn't count. That's a clerical issue. My lieutenant slept as we travelled back to the Cairn. I did not. Tactus and Victor stumbled now ahead of me, walking silently, as if still wrapped in slumber. Despite the heaviness in my shoulders, I don't yearn for sleep. Regret lies behind my bloodshot eyes. If I sleep, I know I'll see the faces of those I left to die in the ship's hallways. I know I'll see Io. I can't face her today. The academy smells of antiseptic and flowers. The rose petals sit in bins off to the side. Ducts above recycle our breaths and purify the air, making a steady hum. Fluorescents piss pale light down from the ceiling, as if to remind us that this is not a kind place for children or fantasies. The light, like the men and women here, is harsh and cold. Roke stays at my side as we walk, though his aspect is deathly. I tell him to get some sleep. He's earned it.
"And what have you earned?" he asks.
"Not a day of sulking. Not a day of self-flagellation.
Of all the lancers, you are second. Second? Brother, why not take pride in that?"
"Not now, Roke."
"Come now," he continues. "It's not victory that makes a man. It's his defeats. You think our ancestors never lost?
You don't need to huff and puff about this and make yourself one of those Greek clichés. Drop the hubris. It was just a game."
"You think I give a shit about the game?"
I wheel on him. "People are dead. They chose lives of service to the fleet. They knew the danger and died for a cause."
"What cause?"
"To keep our society strong."
I stare at him. Could my friend, my kind friend, be so blind? What choice did these people have? They were conscripted.
I shake my head. "You don't understand a thing, do you?"
"Of course I don't understand. You never let anyone in. Not me, not Severo. Look how you treated Mustang. You drive friends away as though they were enemies."
"If he only knew."
I find the garden abandoned. It sits at the top of the Cairn, a large vestibule of glass, earth and greenery designed as a retreat for fluorescent-weary soldiers. Stunted trees sway in a simulated breeze. I take off my shoes, peel off my socks, and sigh as the grass goes between my toes. Lamps above the trees make a false sun. I lay beneath them till, with a groan, I pull myself up toward the small hot spring that lies in the centre of the glade. Bruises, most faded, stain my body like little ponds of blue and purple ringed with yellowing sands. The water soothes my aches. I'm thinner than I should be, but strung tight as piano wire. Were my arm not broken, I'd say I was healthier than at the Institute. Fighting on Academy bacon and eggs beats the shit out of the half-raw goat meat of that place. I find the hemanthus blossom by the side of the pool. It took life where no water laps. It's indigenous to Mars, like me, so I do not pick it. I buried Io in a place like this. Buried her in the fake forest above Lycos Mine, where I last made love to her. We were scrawny, innocent things then. How could so frail a girl have such a spirit, such a dream as freedom, when so many strong souls toiled and kept their heads down for fear of looking up? I shouted at Roke that I did not care about the defeat. Yet, I do.
And there's guilt for caring about that when so many lives should demand all my sorrow. But before today, victory made me full, because with every victory I've come closer to making Io's dream real. Now defeat has robbed me of that. I failed her today. As if knowing my thoughts, my data pad tickles my arm. Augustus calls. I peel the hair-thin display off and close my eyes. His words echo in memory. Even if you lose, even if you cannot take the victory for yourself, do not allow a Bellona triumph. Another fleet under their control will tip the scales of power. So much for that. I float in the water, drifting in and out of sleep till my fingers wrinkle and I grow bored. I'm not meant for these quiet moments. I pull myself from the water to dress. I can't keep Augustus waiting for long. Time to face the old lion. Then sleep, maybe. I'll have to stand and watch the damn victory for Carnus. But after that, I'll be away from this ugly place and headed back to Mars. And maybe Mustang. But as I turn to leave the pool, I find my clothes are gone. As is my razor. Then I sense them. Hearing their military boots behind me, their loud, excited breaths, four of them, I guess, I pick a stone from the ground. No. I turn and I find seven blocking the one entrance into the garden, all golds of House Bellona, all my blood enemies. Carnus comes with the Bellona fresh from his ship. His face is as haggard as mine, his shoulders maybe half again as broad. He towers over me, an obsidian in every way but birth and mind. That laughing mouth of his grins with uncommon intelligence. He rubs a hand over his dimpled chin, muscled forearms looking like they're carved from smoothed river wood. There's something terrifying about being in the presence of someone so large that you can feel the vibrations of their voice in your bones.
Looks like we caught the Augustus lion away from his pride. Lo, Reaper.
Goliath, I mutter, using his call sign. Goliath the Breaker. Goliath the Sun Killer. Goliath the Savage. Mustang says he once broke the spine of a fancy loon-born gold over his knee, after the brat thought to splash a drink in his face at a pearl club. His mother then bribed the judiciary to let him off with a fine. The list of fines he's paid for murder stretches longer than my arm. Greys, pinks, even a violet. But his true reputation comes from killing Claudius Au Augustus, the arch-governor's favourite son and heir, Mustang's brother. Carnus's cousins orbit around him. All Bellona. All born under the blue and silver sigil of the conquering eagle. Brothers, sisters, cousins to Cassius. Their hair is curly and thick, faces all beauty. Their influence stretches across the society, as does the reputation of their arms. One is much older than I, shorter but more powerfully built, like a tree stump with blonde moss covering his head. He is a man in his 30s. Kellen, I remember now, a full legate, a knight of the society. And he came here with his brothers and cousins, for me. Arrogance drips off that one. He feigns a yawn as he plays these schoolyard games. Fear thunders into my chest. I find it difficult to breathe, yet I smile, fingers grazing the datapad's comm functions behind my back.
Seven Bellona, I chuckle. What need have you of seven, Carnus?
You had seven ships against my one,
Carnus says.
I've come to continue our game.
He cocks his head,
Did you think it ended with your ship dying?
The game is over, I say. You won.
Did I win, Reaper?
Karnas asks. At the cost of 833 people.
Whining because you lost?
Asks Cagney. She's the smallest of his cousins, a 20-something lancer to Karnas' father. She's the one cradling my razor, the one Mustang gave me. She swishes it through the air.
I think I'll keep this. I don't think I've even heard of you using it. Not that I'd charge. Razors are tricky. The perils of an uneducated upbringing, I fear.
Go stick your fist up your cousin, I sneer. Must be a reason you curly-haired shits all look alike.
Must we listen to him bark, Karnas?
Cagney whines.
I taught Julian to fish, Reaper.
Kellen, the legate, says suddenly. As a boy, he didn't like it because he thought it hurt the fish too much, thought it was cruel. That's the boy your master had you kill. That is the measure of his cruelty. So, how grand do you feel? How brave do you fashion yourself?
I did not want to kill him. Oh, but we want to kill you.
Karnas rumbles. He nods to his cousins. Two of the Bellona break branches off the trees and toss them to their kin. They have razors, but apparently they want to take their time. If you kill me, there'll be consequences, I say. This is not a sanctioned duel, and I am peerless. I am protected by the compact. This will be murder. The Olympic Knights will hunt you, try you, execute you.
Who said anything of murder?
Karnas asks.
You belong to Cassius.
Cagney's fox-like face splits with a smile.
Today you are protected by Augustus.
Karnas says.
His chosen boy. To kill you would mean war. But no one goes to war over a little beating.
Cagney favours her left leg. Knee injury. A cousin of hers leans on his heels. Frightened of me. The big one, Karnas, squares up, meaning he doesn't give a piss about whatever damage I can deal. Kellen smiles and stands relaxed. I hate those sort of men. Hard to judge. I calculate my chances. Then I remember my broken arm. My injured ribs. And the contusion of my eye, and cut those chances in half. I'm scared. They cannot kill me, I cannot kill them. Not here, not now. All of us know how this dance will end, but dance we do. Karnas snaps his fingers, and they rush toward me all at once. I throw the stone into Cagney's face. She goes down. I rush at Karnas, howling like a mad wolf, slipping past his first blow, and rage a flurry of strikes into his nerve centres, driving my elbow into his right bicep, rupturing tissue. He rocks back, and I press into him, using his bulk to shield me from the others and their sticks. I strip a stick away from one of the Bellona cousins, levelling her with an elbow to her temple. Then I turn, spinning the stick toward Karnas' face, but it's blocked. Something hits the back of my head. Wood shatters. Splinters dig into the scalp. I don't stumble. Not until Karnas hits me so hard in my face with his elbow that a tooth pops out. They don't take turns coming one by one. They surround me, and they punish me with the efficiency of their deadly art, cravat. They aim for nerves, organs. I manage to stand, hit a few of my assailants, but I'm not long on my feet. Someone jams their stick into my skin, impacting the subcostal nerve. I drip down to the ground like melting wax, and Karnas kicks me in the head. I bite through half my tongue. Warmth fills my mouth. The ground is the softest thing I feel.
choking on salt. Blood and air spray out of my mouth as Carnus puts his foot on my stomach, then throat. He laughs.
In the words of Lorne Au Arcos, if you must only wound the man, you better kill his pride.
I gurgle for breath. Cagney replaces Carnus, sitting on my chest, knees pinning down my arms. I suck down air. She smiles in my face and looks at my hairline, lips parted with excitement of dominating another person. She twists my hair into her grip. Her hot breath smells like spearmint.
"What have we here?"
she asks, pulling my datapad from its place on my arm.
"Damn it. He hailed the Augustans. I'd rather not fight that Julii bitch without my armor."
"Then stop dawdling," Carnus growls. "Do it."
"Shh," she whispers as I try to speak, tracing a knife over my lips, pushing it into my mouth till the brittle metal clacks against my teeth. "That's a good little bitch." Roughly, she saws off my hair. "Nice and quiet. Good, Reaper. Good."
Blood stings my eyes as Carnus shoves Cagney off my chest, grabs me, and hoists me off the ground with his left hand. He flexes his right arm, cursing about his ruined bicep. He can't pull it back to swing a punch, so instead he grins toothily at me and headbutts me once in the chest, just at the sternum. My world rocks. There's a crackle, the sound of twigs over a fire. I wheeze out bubbling, inhuman sounds. Carnus headbutts me again and tosses my aching body to the ground. I feel warmth splash over me, and the smell of piss claw into my nostrils. They laugh, and Carnus breathes into my ear.
"Mother bid me to tell you, a pauper can never be a prince. Every time you look in the mirror, remember what we did to you. Remember you breathe because we let you. Remember your heart will one day be on our table. Rise so high, in mud you lie."
Chapter 4. Fallen. I stand before my master, but he does not care. The office walls are of panelled wood, and on the floor lies an ancient rug his iron ancestor took from a palace of earth after the fall of the Indian Empire, one of the last great nations to stand against gold. What dread those natural-born humans must have felt to see the conquerors falling from the sky, man perfected, but bringing chains instead of hope. I stand in front of Augustus's desk, a bare thing of wood and iron, just before the 700-year-old bloodstain where the final Indian emperor had his head parted from his body by a sleek gold killer. Idly, Nero Au Augustus strokes the lion that lies beside his desk. They look like twin statues. Behind them is space. A viewport peers into the blackness, where the ships of the Scepter Armada lie like giant golems in terrible slumber. We pass them on the last leg of our 3-week voyage from Mars. Augustus peers at his desk as a stream of data runs over the wood. It seems so long ago that he took me on a tour of Mars to show me our domains, from the Latfundias where high reds toil over crops, to the great polar reaches where obsidians live in medieval isolation. He favoured me then, bringing me close, teaching me the things his father taught him. I was his favourite, second only to Leto. Now he is a stranger, and I an embarrassment. It's been 2 months since the day Carnus beat me at the academy. Though my hair has grown back and my broken bones have mended, my reputation has not. and because of that, my tenure in Arch-Governor Augustus's employ is tenuous, at best. My enemies grow by the day, but these new ones prefer whispers to razors. More and more do I believe the sons of Ares chose the wrong man. I am not made for the cold war of politics, not made for subtlety. Hell, I'd hide a boy in the gut of a horse any day, but I wouldn't know how to bribe someone properly if my life depended on it. A gentle, warm voice, made for half-truths, drifts through the Arch-Governor's office. Three refineries, two nightclubs, and two grey police outposts. All bombed since we left Mars. 7 attacks, my liege. 59 gold fatalities. Pliny. Slender as a salamander, with skin as smooth as a pink's. The politico is no peerless scard, never even went to the Institute. His glittering eyes peer out from eyelashes that would put peacock plumage to shame. Muted lipstick coats thin lips. His hair is coiled and scented. His body thin but muscular, in a pleasing but utterly facile way, beneath a too tight embroidered silk tunic. A child could beat the living hell out of this beautiful kitten of a man. Yet he's ended families with a rumour here, a joke there. His power is of a different breed. Where I am kinetic energy, he is potential. I've heard he's also responsible for ruining my reputation. Tactus even hinted that Pliny might have put Carnus up to the violence in the garden, or, at the very least, arranged a holocam to record my proud moment. Beside Pliny stands the fourth man in the room, Leto. He's a bright lancer 10 years my senior, with braided hair and a half-moon grin. He's also a poet with the razor, a younger Lorne au Arcos, according to some. It's likely he'll inherit Augustus's estate instead of the Arch-Governor's blood heirs, Mustang and the Jackal. Truth be told, I rather like the man.
The sons of Ares grow too bold, Augustus mutters. Yes, my liege.
Pliny squints. If it is indeed they who perpetrate the acts.
What other ant bites us?
None that we know of, but there are spiders, ticks, rats in the worlds.
The bombings are crude for Ares, indiscriminate, uncharacteristically violent, discontiguous from the pattern of technological sabotage and propaganda in his profile. Ares is not capricious, so I struggle believing these acts originate from him.
Augustus frowns. Then what do you suggest?
Perhaps there is another terrorist group, my liege. With 18 billion souls on the census, I hardly think one man has a monopoly on terrorism. Perhaps even a criminal syndicate. I've been creating a database I can share.
Pliny is right. The terror attacks that have plagued Mars and other planets make little sense.
Dancer spoke of justice, not revenge. These attacks are petty and gruesome. The bombing of barracks, fashion outlets, bazaars, high-colour coffee shops and restaurants. Ares would never condone them. They draw too many eyes for too little result, daring the gulls to act, to crush the suns. I've sent messages to Dancer via the hollow box. Nothing. Just silence. Could he be dead? Or has Ares abandoned me for this new strategy of bombing?
Pliny yawns.
Perhaps Ares has changed his tactics. He's a deuced one.
If Ares is a man, Leto says.
Interesting. Augustus swivels abruptly. What makes you think Ares isn't a man?
Why do we assume Ares is a man? He could be a woman. Could be a group of individuals, for all we know, which would go a long way toward explaining the discordant nature of these new attacks.
Leto turns to me, eyes inclusive.
Dara, what do you think? Don't befuddle Darrow with complex questions. Pliny crows defensively. Make it a yes or no so he can understand. Pliny flashes me the most pitying of smiles and squeezes my shoulder in sympathy. Behind his leopard smiles, he's an honest, simple beast. You should know that. I stand there and take it. He turns away. In any manner, Leto, you're forgetting we designed Red Culture to be highly patriarchal. Their identity as a people centers around the collection of resources to propagate the embryonic terraforming of Mars. Physically strenuous, grueling tasks performed by men. Tasks we don't let their women perform, even if they are capable, pursuant to the stratification protocol. So, you see, it can't be a woman, because no roughneck ruster would follow a man or woman who has never ridden a claw drill. Leto smiles cleverly. If Ares is a red. Pliny and Augustus both laugh. Maybe he's a deranged violet who's taking his acting to a new stage, Pliny offers. Or a copper cambist beleaguered by filing provincial tax returns, Leto adds. No, an obsidian who, dare I say, has finally forsaken his terror of technology and developed the skills to use a holocamera. Pliny slaps his leg. I'd give away one of my roses just to see... My goodman, enough. Augustus cuts him off, tapping his finger on the desk. Pliny and Leto share a grin and turn back to Augustus. Your recommendation, Pliny?
Of course.
Pliny clears his throat. Unlike their propaganda and cyber attacks, the brutality is quite simple to counter. Ares or not, issue a reply. Our kill teams are prepared for tactical strikes on several terrorist training grounds beneath Mars's surface. We should strike now. If we wait, I fear the Sovereign's Praetorians will take matters into their own hands. Loonborn don't understand Mars. They'll slag it up. A fool pulls the leaves. A brute chops the trunk. A sage digs the roots. Augustus pauses. Something Lorne Au Arcos once said to my father. It's engraved on the Hall of Blades in New Thebes. Striking training grounds will do nothing except fill the hollow net with pretty explosions. I tire of political plays. Our strategy must change. With every bombing, the Sovereign grows wearier of my administration. You govern Mars, Leto says. Not Venus or Earth. Ours is not a placid planet. What does she expect? Results.
What do you have in mind, my liege?
Pliny asks.
I intend to poison the sons of Ares as roots. I want suicide bombers, not greys. Find the ugliest, nastiest reds on Mars, hold their families hostage, and threaten to kill their sons and daughters if the fathers do not do as we command. Focus the suicide bombers on surface areas with high youth density, as well as two choice mines. No women bombers. I want social divide. Women against violence.
How little life costs here. Just words in the air.
Urban areas, too, he continues. Not just browns and red miners and agriculturists. I want dead blue and green children in schools or arcades next to Sons of Ares glyphs. Then we'll see if other colours still sing that girl's gory damn song.
My heart dips a beat. Io's song spread further than she dreamed, reaching the holonet and ripping across the solar system, shared over a billion times thanks to anarchist hacker groups. Time and again, I fear I'll be recognized. Perhaps some gold will search through the records to find that Io's husband's name was also Darrow. But even I hardly recognize that skeletal, pale boy. And as for names, there are no true records for low red names. I had a number designation given to me by some officious copper administrator, L17L6363, and
L17L6363 was hanged from his neck until dead, whereupon his body was stolen by an unknown perpetrator and presumably buried in the deep mines.
You plan to alienate Red from the other colours, then alienate the Suns from Red.
Pliny smiles.
My liege, sometimes I wonder why you even need me.
Do not patronise me, Pliny. It's beneath the both of us.
Pliny bows.
Indeed. Apologies, my liege.
Augustus looks back to Leto.
You're squirming like a pup. I worry this will make matters worse.
Leto frowns to himself.
Presently the Suns are a nuisance, yes, but hardly our chief plight. If we do this, we could be pouring fuel on the flames, and worse, we'd be as guilty as the Suns themselves. Terrorists.
There is no guilt.
Pliny peers idly at a stream of data on his datapad.
Not when you're the judge.
Leto isn't satisfied.
My liege, our imperative to rule exists because we are fit to best guide mankind. We are Plato's philosopher kings. Our cause is order. We provide stability. The Suns are anarchists. Their cause is chaos. We should use that as our weapon, not greys in the night, bombers among children.
We should aspire to a higher purpose?
Pliny asks.
Yes. Perhaps fashion a media campaign against the Suns. Dara, wouldn't you agree?
Again, I do not answer. Not until the Arch-Governor acknowledges my presence. He does not value impudence or impropriety unless it benefits him.
Idealism.
Pliny sighs.
Admirable in the young, if misguided.
Take care in talking down to me, Politico.
Leto growls, scanning Pliny's smirking face for the absent peerless scar.
Your plan should be less brutal, Arch-Governor. That is my point.
Brutality.
Augustus lets the word hang in the air.
It is neither evil nor good. It is simply an adjective of a thing, an action in this case. What you must pass is the nature of the action. Is it evil or good to stop terrorists who bomb innocents? Good, I suppose. Then what do our methods matter, so long as we harm fewer innocents than they would harm if we continue to allow them to exist?
Augustus folds his long-fingered hands.
But, at the core, this is no philosophical issue. It is a political one. The Sons of Ares are not the threat. Not at all. All they are is a weapon for our political enemies, namely the Bellona, to use as an excuse to claim I cannot control Mars.
The curly hairs already seek to strip me of the governorship. As you know, the Sovereign has sole power to remove me from the position, even without a vote from the Senate. If she wishes, she can give Mars to another house. Bellona, our allies the Julii, even a non-Martian house. None of these entities would run Mars as effectively as I. And when Mars is run effectively, all benefit, low and high. I am not a despot, but a father must cuff the ears of his children if they make an attempt to set fire to his house. If I must kill a few thousand for the greater good, for helium-3 to flow, and for the citizens of this planet to continue to live in a world untorn by war, then I will. Which brings us to Darrow Au Andromedus.
Now his cold eyes turn on me, fresh from ordering the deaths of 1,000 innocents, and I cannot help but flinch as a dark hate rises inside me. I bow my head in polite deference.
My liege, you summoned me?
I did, and your purpose here shall be brief. You were a gambit when I took you from the Institute and put you in my employ. You know this?
Yes.
I thought your merit to be sufficient. I found your rivalry with Cassius Albalona amusing, in a schoolyard way. But the blood feud declared between you has become... He spares a glance at Pliny. Burdensome to my interests, both economically and politically. Substantial revenues have been lost due to tariff increases to the core, where Bologna supporters lie. Houses waver in their commitment to honouring deals made years ago at the trade table. So, as an act of reconciliation to these aggrieved parties, I have decided to sell your contract to another house.
I shudder inside. My liege, I try to interject. This cannot happen. If he strips me of my place, nearly 3 years of work will have been for nothing.
If I may.
You may not.
He opens a drawer and idly tosses the slab of meat to his lion. The lion waits for Augustus to snap his fingers before eating.
The decision was made a month ago. There is no use bandying words with me. I'm not Quicksilver negotiating the price of lithium futures. Pliny!
The particulars are rather simple, Darrow, so they shall be easy to grasp.
Pliny hasn't taken his eyes from me.
The Arch-Governor has been overly kind in giving you the fair warning in case of termination, as stipulated in your contract.
My contract says I'm to be given 6 months' fair warning.
If you'll recall, Section 8, Subsection C, Clause 4, you're to be given 6 months' fair warning unless you fail to act in a manner befitting a lancer of the esteemed House Augustus.
Is this a joke?
I look to Leto and Augustus.
Do you see us laughing?
Pliny asks primly. No? Not even a scoff? Or chortle?
Of all the lancers, I came in second at the academy. You couldn't even make it through the institute.
Oh, it's not that. You did well. Enough.
Then what?
It is your constant presence on the HC talk shows.
I've never gone on the HC. I don't even watch it.
Oh, please. You relish your own celebrity. Even though they mock you, you bathe in the limelight and cloak this house with shame. We know your datapad search histories. We see you preening at yourself in the HC as though it were your personal mirror. The stories run on you and the Arch-Governor's daughter.
Mustang is in court on Luna,
which you likely encouraged. Did you ask her to join the Sovereign's Court? Is it part of your plan to divide daughter from father?
You're spinning horseshit, Pliny.
And you create a tawdry name for Augustus. You brawl with Bologna in baths set aside for refreshment and contemplation. This we cannot abide.
I don't even know what to say. He's making it up. There's enough in reality to make a case, but he lies just to spit in my eye, just to show that I am in his power. Pliny continues.
The termination of the contract will occur in 3 days.
3 days,
I echo.
Till then, you will accompany us to the surface of Luna and stay in the residence provided for the House Augustus for the summit, though, as of this moment, you are no longer a lancer of this house. You do not represent the Arch-Governor, and may not use his name to gain access to facilities nor curry favour with young ladies or young men, neither in boast, promise, or threat. Your house datapad will be confiscated, your Lancer ID codes have already been downgraded, and you will cease and desist participation in all projects to which you were previously assigned.
I have only been assigned construction projects.
Pliny's lips crawl into a reptilian smile.
Then this shall be an easy transition.
To whom am I being sold?
I manage. Augustus doesn't look in my eyes as he abandons me. He pets his lion. You would guess I'm not even in the room.
Leto stares at the ground, ashamed. He's nobler than this charade.
but Augustus wants him here to watch, to learn how to amputate a rotten limb.
You are not being sold, Darrow. Despite your birth, I would have expected you to understand your plays. We are not pinks or obsidians to be sold as slaves. Your services are being traded at auction,
Pliny says.
It's the same gory thing, I hiss. You're abandoning me. Whoever buys my services cannot protect me from the Bellona. Those curly-haired bastards will hunt me down and kill me. The only reason they didn't 2 months ago was because...
Because you were an Augustan representative? Pliny asks. But the arch-governor does not owe you anything, Darrow. Is that the misapprehension you suffer? In fact, you owe him. Protecting you costs us money. It costs us opportunities, contracts, trade. And that cost has proven too dear. We must be seen to promote peace with the Bellona. The sovereign wants peace. You're a source of friction, a chafing burr in our proverbial saddle, and an instrument of war. So now we melt our sword into a plowshare. But not before you use it to lop off my head.
Darrow, do not beg. Pliny sighs. Show some resolve, young man. Your time here has expired, yes, but you've got pluck. You've got the vigour of a young man. Now, straighten that spine of yours and leave with the dignity of a gold who knows he tried his best.
His eyes laugh at me. That means leave this office. Now, my goodman, before Leto throws you out on your preposterously toned buttocks.
I stare at the arch-governor. Is this what you take me for? Some snivelling child to be pushed into a corner?
Darrow, it'd be best if... Leto begins. It is you who have pushed us into a corner, Pliny answers, putting a hand on my shoulder. If you're worried you won't receive a severance package, you will. Enough money to...
The last time one of the arch-governor's lackeys touched me, I buried a knife in his cerebellum 6 times.
I look at his hand as he quickly withdraws it. I square my shoulders.
I do not answer to a scarless pixie whelp. I am a peerless scard. Arch-primus of the 542nd class of the Institute of Mars. I answer to the Arch-Governor alone.
I take a step toward Augustus, causing Leto to take a protective angle. The length of my temper is well remembered.
You put Julian Au Bellona in the passage with me, my liege.
My eyes burn down at him.
I killed him there for you. I warred against Carnus for you. I kept my mouth, the mouths of my men, sealed after you tried to buy your son victory at the Institute.
Leto flinches at that.
I altered the recordings. I proved myself better than your blood heirs. Now, my liege, you say I'm a liability.
You are a peerless scard. The arch-governor agrees, examining data on his desk. But you are of little substance. Your family is dead. They left you with no lands, no holdings of resources or industry, no position in government. All were seized as their debts came due, including their honour. What scraps you have been given by your betters, cherish. What favour you carried, remember. I thought you favoured deeds, not titles. My liege, Mustang has left you. Do not make the mistake of severing me from you as well.
Finally, he raises his head to look at me. Eyes belonging to some creature beyond man, a distant, callous calculation fueled by monstrous, inhuman pride. A pride that goes beyond him and stretches back to man's first feeble steps into black space. It is the pride of a dozen generations of fathers and grandfathers and sisters and brothers, all distilled now into a single, brilliant, perfect vessel that bears no failure, abides no flaws. My enemies embarrassed you,
So they embarrassed me, Darrow. You told me you would win, but then you lost. And that changes everything.
Chapter 5. Abandoned. I will soon die.
That is the thought I carry with me as our shuttle coasts away from Augustus's flagship and flits through the Scepter Armada. I sit among the Lancers, but I am not one of them. They know. Appropriately, they do not speak to me. Whatever bond they could make does not matter. I have no political capital. I overhear Tactus being offered a wager to see how long I'll last outside of Augustus's protection. One Lancer says 3 days. Tactus argues ferociously against the number, showing the true extent of the loyalty I earned from him at the Institute.
10 days, he declares. At least 10 days.
It was he who launched the escape pod without me. I always knew his friendship was conditional. Yet still, the wound gnaws deep, carving in me a loneliness I can't express. A loneliness I've always felt among these gulls, but tricked myself into forgetting. I am not one of them. So I sit there in silence, staring out the window as we pass the gathered fleet and wait for Luna to appear. My contract ends on the final evening of the summit, where all ruling families gather on Luna to deal with matters pressing and frivolous. That is the 3-day window I have to improve my stock, to make others think that I am undervalued by the Arch-Governor and ripe for recruitment. But no matter my value, I am marred. Someone had me, then threw me away. Who would want such a used thing? This is my fate. Despite my golden face and talents, I am a commodity. It makes me want to tear my bloody damn sigils out. If I'm to be a slave, I should at least look a slave. To make matters worse, there's a price on my head. Not officially, of course. That is illegal, because I am not an enemy of the state. Yet my enemy is far worse. Far crueler than any government. She is the woman who sent Carnus and Cagney to the Academy. They say every night since I stole Julian's life in the passage, his mother, Julia Au Bellona, has sat at the long table of her family's high hall up on the slopes of Olympus Mons, and lifted the semicircular lid of the silver tray brought to her by the pink manservants. Every night, the tray remains empty. And every night she sighs in sadness, peering down the table at her large family, only to repeat the same vindictive words. It is clear I am unloved. If I were loved, there would be a heart here to sate my hunger for vengeance. If I were loved, my boy's murderer would no longer draw breath. If I were loved, my family would honour their brother. But I am not. He is not. They do not. What have I done to deserve such a hateful family? Then the grand Bellona family will watch their matriarch uncoil from her chair, her body withering from hunger, nursing instead on hate and vengeance. And they will remain silent as she leaves the room, more wraith than woman. What has kept my heart from her plate is the Arch-Governor's arms, money and name. Politics, the very thing I hate, has kept the breath in me. But in 3 days, that aegis will be a shadow of memory, and all that will protect me are the lessons my teachers have given me.
It'll be a duel, one of the Lancers says. Then louder, can't turn that down and keep his honour for long. Not if Cassius himself offers it. Old Reaper has a few tricks up his sleeve, Tactus says. You might not have been there, but he didn't kill Apollo with his smile. Used a razor, didn't you, Darrow?
Another Lancer asks, tone mocking.
Haven't seen you on the fencing grounds of late. You've never seen him there, says another. The pixie avoids what he's not good at, eh?
Roke stirs angrily beside me. I put a hand on his forearm and turn slowly to regard the offending Lancer. Victra sits behind him, idly watching the scene. I don't fence, I say.
Don't or can't?
Someone asks with a laugh.
Leave him be. Razor masters are expensive,
Tactus notes with a sly grin. Is that how it is, Tactus? I ask. He makes a face.
Oh, come now. Just having a go at you. So gory damn serious. You used to be more playful.
Roke says something to make Tactus scowl and turn away, but I don't hear.
I've sunken into memory, where this golden game once seemed so easy.
What has changed?
Mustang. You're more than this, she whispered, as I left her for the academy. Tears swelled in her eyes, though her voice did not waver. You don't have to be a killer. You don't have to court war.
What other choice do I have? I asked.
Me. I'm the other choice. Stay for me. Stay for what might be. At the Institute, you made followers of boys and girls who have never known loyalty. If you go to the Academy, you abandon that to be my father's warlord. That's not what you are. That's not the man I...
She did not turn, but her face changed as her sentence trailed away, lips drawing a hard line.
Love? Was that what we built in the year after the Institute?
If so, the word stuck in her throat, because she knew, as I knew, that I had not given her all of me. I had not shared all that I am. Greedily, I kept secrets. And how could someone like her, someone with so much self-worth, bare herself and throw her heart at a man who gave so little in return? So she closed her golden eyes, shoved the razor into my hands, and told me to go. I don't fault her. She chose politics, governance, peace, which is what she thinks her people need. I chose the blade because it is what my people need. It fills me with a strange emptiness knowing that I was enough for her when I was never enough for Io. Roke was right. I pushed her away. I didn't push Severo away. I asked him to be stationed with me, then suddenly he was reassigned to Pluto, like many of the Howlers, relegated to protecting far construction operations from petty pirate raids. I now suspect Pliny's hand in that.
My path has never felt lonelier. You'll not be abandoned, Roke says, leaning in close. Other families will want you for themselves. Don't let Tactus in your head. The Bologna won't make a move against you.
Of course they won't. I lie. He can still sense my fear.
Violence isn't allowed in the Citadel, Darrow. Especially blood feuds. Even duels are outlawed unless consent is given by the Sovereign herself. Simply stay on Citadel grounds till you've a new house and all will be well. Bide your time. Do what you must. And in a year, the Arch-Governor will feel like a fool when you've risen under the tutelage of another. There is more than one path to the top. Always remember that, brother.
He grips my shoulder.
You know, I would ask my mother and father to bid for you,
But they won't go against Augustus.
I know. They could spend the millions on the contract and not even notice the loss. But Roke's mother has not sat a senator for 20 years because of her charity. Her lot is thrown in with Augustus's contingent in the Senate. What he wills, she supports. I'll be fine. You're right.
I say, as Luna appears in the window, hushing the aides and filling me with dread. The city moon of Earth, orbiting satellites and installations encircle it like a steel angel's halo wrapped around a ball of amber held to the sun.
I'll be fine.
Chapter 6. Icarus. We land near the citadel. Sticky, polluted wind bends the towering trees near our landing pad. Perspiration quickly beads along the top of my high collar. Already I do not like this ugly place. Despite the fact that we land here on citadel grounds, which are far from the nearest cities and surrounded by forests and lakes, Luna's air cloys and sticks to the lungs. On the horizon, just past the spiked spires of the citadel's western campus, Earth hovers, swollen and blue, reminding me that I am so far from home. The gravity here is less than Mars's, only 1/6 Earth's, and it makes me feel unsettled and clumsy. I seem to float when I walk, and even though coordination quickly returns, my body suffers its own lightness with strange feelings of claustrophobia. Another vessel lands to the north.
Looks like Bellona Silva, Roke says quietly, squinting against the sunset.
I chuckle.
He glances back at me.
What?
Just imagining having a pulse rocket right about now.
Well, that's just lovely of you.
He walks along. I follow, eyes lingering on the vessel.
I do love the sunsets of Luna, like we're in Homer's world. Sky a hot shade of fresh-forged bronze.
Above, the alien sky melts into the night with the long setting of the sun. For 2 weeks, the daylight will disappear from this part of the moon. 2 weeks of night. Luxury yachts cruise through this strange day's end, while nimble, blue-piloted rip wings roar past on patrol, like bats glued together from shattered ebony. The 1/6 gravity lets these loon-born build to their heart's desire, and build they do. Beyond the citadel grounds, the horizon is fenced with towers and cityscape. Rung paths wind everywhere so that citizens can pull themselves through the air with ease. The network of rungs stretch between high towers, as would ivy, linking the heavens with the hells of the low districts. Along them, thousands of men and women crawl like ants on vines, while grey patrol skiffs buzz around the thoroughfares. The household of Augustus is assigned a villa nestled within 30 acres of pines on citadel grounds. It's a pretty thing among other pretty things in this stately place. There are gardens, paths, fountains carved with little winged boys of stone, all that sort of frivolity.
Fancy a session of cravat? I ask Roke, nodding to the training facility beside the villa. My mind's running away with itself.
I can't.
Roke winces, stepping out of the way of our fellow lancers and their attendants who file into the villa. I have to attend the conference on capitalism in the governed age.
If you wanted a nap, I'm sure they have beds in the villa.
You joking?
Regulus Agsoon is giving the keynote.
I whistle.
Quicksilver himself. So you're going to learn how to make diamonds out of gravel. You hear the rumour about him owning the contracts of 2 Olympic knights?
It's not a rumour, least according to Mother.
Reminds me of what Augustus said to the sovereign at her coronation. A man is never too young to kill, never too wise, never too strong, but he can damn well be too rich. Arco said that. No, I'm sure it was Augustus. I shake my head. Check your facts, brother. Lorn au Arco said it. And the sovereign turned to reply, You forget, Rage Knight, I am a woman. Arcos is as much myth as man, at least to my generation. Reclusive now, he was the Sword of Mars and the Rage Knight for over 60 years. Peerless knights across the society have offered him the deeds to moons if he would but tutor them for a week in his form of cravat, the Willow Way. It was he who sent me the knife ring that killed Apollo and then offered me a place in his house. I rejected it then, choosing Augustus over the old man. You forget I am a woman, Roke repeats. He cherishes these stories of their empire, the way I cherished stories of the Reaper and the Veil. When I get back, let's talk, not the usual banter. You mean you won't yammer on about a childhood crush, drink too much wine, wax poetic about the shape of Quinn's smile and the beauty of Etruscan gravesites before falling asleep? I ask. His cheeks flush, but he puts a hand over his heart. On my honour. Then bring a bottle of foolishly expensive wine and we can talk.
I'll bring three. I watch him leave, eyes colder than my smile.
Several of the other Lancers attend the conference with Roke. The rest make themselves comfortable as Augustus's grey security teams comb the grounds. Obsidian bodyguards trail goals like shadows. Pinks sway gracefully into the villa in a constant stream, ordered from the Citadel's garden by members of the Arch-Governor's household staff, who find themselves bored from travel and seek a little merriment. A pink Citadel steward guides me to my room. I laugh when I arrive. Perhaps there has been a mistake, I say, looking around the small room with its adjoining washroom and closet. I'm not a broom.
I don't under... He's not a broom, so he won't fit in this closet, Theodora says, standing in the doorway behind us. It is beneath his station.
She looks around, pert nose sniffing disdainfully. These would not even suit as closet to my clothes on Mars.
This is the Citadel, not Mars.
The steward's pink eyes survey the lines on Theodora's aged face. There is less room for useless things. Theodora smiles sweetly and gestures to the rose quartz tree pinned to the man's breast.
I say, is that the black poplar of Garden Dryope?
Your first time seeing it, I would guess, he says haughtily before turning to me. I don't know how they raised your pinks in Mars's gardens, Dominus, but on Luna your slave should do her best to look less affected.
Of course. How rude of me.
Theodora apologizes.
I merely thought you would know Matron Carena.
The steward pauses.
Matron Carena? We were girls together in the gardens. Tell her Theodora says hello and would call on her if time is found.
You're a rose. His face goes sheet white.
Was. All petals wilt. Oh, but do tell me your name. I would so like to commend you to her for your hospitality.
He mumbles something quite inaudible and departs, bowing lower to Theodora than to me. Was that fun? I ask.
Always nice to flex a little muscle, even if everything else is starting to droop.
Seems my career ends where yours began. I chuckle morbidly and walk over to the holo display sitting near the bed. I wouldn't, she says. I bite my bottom lip, our signal for spying devices.
Well, of course, that. But the holonet is not where you want to be right now.
What are they saying about me?
They're wondering where you'll be buried.
I haven't time to reply before knuckles rap against the frame of my room's doorway.
Dominus, Lady Juliae requests your presence.
I follow Victoris Pink to her room's private terrace. Her bath alone is larger than my bed.
It's not fair,
a voice says from behind the ivory-white trunk of a lavender tree. I turn to see Victra playing with the thorns of a shrub.
You been cut loose like a grey mercenary?
Since when have you been concerned with what's fair, Victra?
Must you always fence with me?
She asks.
Come, sit.
Even with the scars that distinguish her from her sister, her long form and luminous face is without true fault. She sits smoking some designer burner that smells like a sunset over a logged forest. She's heavier of bone than Antonia, taller, and seems to have been melted into being, like a spearhead cooling into angular shape. Her eyes flash with annoyance.
I'm as far from an enemy as you have, Darrow.
So what are you? A friend?
A man in your position could use friends, no?
I'd rather have a dozen stained bodyguards.
Who has the money for that?
She laughs. I raise an eyebrow. You do?
Well, they couldn't protect you from yourself.
I'm a bit more worried about Bellona razors.
Worry? Is that what I saw on your face as we descended?
She lets a merry sigh escape her lips.
Curious. See, I thought it was dread. Terror. All the truly unsettling things. Because you know this moon will be your grave.
I thought we weren't fencing anymore. I say,
you're right. It's just I find you very odd. Or at least I find your choice in friends to be odd.
She is sitting in front of me, on the lip of the fountain. Her heels scrape against the aged stone.
You've always kept me at arm's length while bringing Tactus and Roque close. I understand Roque, even if he is as soft as butter. But Tactus? It's like flossing with a viper and expecting not to get bitten. Is it because he was your man at the Institute that you think he's your friend?
Friend? I laugh at the idea. After Tactus told me how his brothers broke his favourite violin when he was a boy, I had Theodora spend half my bank account on a Stradivarius violin from Quicksilver's auction house. Tactus didn't thank me. It was as if I'd handed him a stone.
He asked what it was for.
I said, for you to play.
He asked why.
Because we're friends. He looked back down at it and walked away. 2 weeks later, I discovered he took it and sold it and used the money for pinks and drugs. He is not my friend.
He is what his brothers made him to be,
she notes, hesitating as if reluctant to share her information with me.
When do you think he's ever received something without someone wanting something in return?
You made him feel uncomfortable. Why do you think I'm wary with you? I lean closer. It's because you always want something, Victra. Just like your sister.
Ah, I thought it might be Antonia. She's always ruining things. Ever since the she-wolf gnawed her way out of Mother's womb and stole human clothes. Good that I was born first, else she might have strangled me in my crib. And she's only my half-sister, anyway. Different fathers. Mother never saw much point in monogamy. You know, Antonia even goes by Severus instead of Juliae just to take a piss on Mother. Cantankerous brat. And I get saddled with her moral baggage. Ridiculous.
Victra plays with the many jade rings on her fingers. I find them odd, contrasting with the Spartan severity of her scarred face. But Victra has always been a woman of contrasts. Why are you talking with me, Victra? I can't do anything for you. I have no station, I have no command, I have no money, and I have no reputation. All the things you value.
Oh, I value other things too, darling.
But you do have a reputation, all right. Pliny's made sure of that. So he did play a part in the gossip. Thought Tactus was just running his mouth.
A part? Darrow, he's been at war with you since the moment you kneeled to Augustus.
She laughs.
Before then, even. He counseled Augustus to kill you then and there, or at least try you for the murder of Apollo. Didn't you know?
She shakes her head at my blank stare.
The fact that you're just now realizing this shows just how ill-equipped you are to play his game. And because of that, you're going to be killed. That's why I'm speaking with you. I'd rather you found an alternative instead of sulking in your beastly quarters. Otherwise, Cassius Aubellona is going to come and he's going to take a knife and dig it right here.
She caresses my chest with a long-nailed finger, etching the outline of my heart. And give his mother her first real meal in years. Then what is your suggestion?
You stop being such a little bitch.
She smiles up at me and holds out a data slip. Grudgingly, I take the edge of the thin metal slip, but she holds on, pulling me towards the edge of the fountain, between her legs. Her lips part, her tongue playing along the top, as her eyes trace my face, up and up to my eyes, where they try to spark a fire. But there's none there. With a feline sigh, she lets the data slip go. I run it over my personal data pad, and an advertisement for a tavern appears on my display. This isn't on Citadel grounds, I say.
So?
So, if I leave, it's open season on my head.
Then don't advertise your leaving.
I take a step back. How much are they paying you?
You think this is a setup?
Is it?
No.
How do I know you're telling the truth?
Most people can't afford the truth. I can.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. You never lie.
I am of the gens Julii.
She stands slowly, anger uncoiling like a razor.
My family trades in commerce enough to buy continents. Who could afford to purchase my honour? If one day I become your enemy, I will tell you, and I will tell you why.
Everyone's honest till they're caught in a lie.
Her laugh is husky and makes me feel small and boyish, reminding me she's 7 years older than I. Then stay, Reaper. Trust in chance. Trust in friends. Hide here till someone buys your contract and pray they didn't do it just to serve you up to the Bologna like a suckling pig.
I weigh the odds and extend a hand to help her up. Well, when you put it that way.
Colonel Valentin?
Victor asks, the shorter of the two greys who wait for us on the ramp of the shuttle. It's a shit can. One of the ugliest flyers I've ever seen. Like the front half of a hammerhead shark. I eye the taller of the greys warily.
Yes, Domina,
Valentin says, nodding his cinder block head with the rigid precision of a man risen through the ranks.
You are sure you were not followed?
Certain as death,
Victor says.
We should depart fast like then.
I follow Victor into the shuttle, scanning the grounds behind us. We wore ghost cloaks as soon as we departed Augustus's villa. A dozen hidden hallways and six old grav lifts later, we arrive in a dusty, seldom-used section of the Citadel's launch pads. Theodora left us there. She wanted to come, but I won't take her where we're going. A grey scans Victor and me for bugs as we board the ship. The ship's ramp slides closed behind us. 12 craggy greys fill the small passenger hold of the shuttle. They're not the dashing sort,
just craftsmen of a dark trade. Though there are averages, colours are diverse in composition due to human genetics and the differing ecosystems throughout the society. The greys of Venus are often darker and more compact than those of Mars, but families move and mix and breed. The talent levels in each colour are even more variable than appearance. Most greys aren't destined for anything more than patrolling shopping centres and city streets. Some go to the armies, some to the mines. But then there are the greys who were born a special breed of wicked and clever, and have been trained all their lives to hunt the gold enemies of their gold masters. Like these in the shuttle with us. They call them lurchers, after the mutt dogs of Earth crossbred for uncommon stealth, cunning and speed, all for one purpose, killing things bigger than they are.
"We're bound for Lost City, and it's just the 12 of you," I ask.
I know they're enough, I just don't like greys, so I push their buttons. They eye me with the quiet reserve of a family meeting a stranger on the road. Valentin's the father. He's built like a squat block of dirty ice carved by a rusted blade, and his sun-blasted face is dark and set with quick eyes. His lieutenant, Soon Hua, leans toward us, tough and gnarled as an olive tree. Both are earthborn by the looks of their continentally ethnic features. These greys wear no triangular badge of the Society's Legion on their civilian street clothes, means they've served their mandatory 20 years.
"We're tasked with your protection, Dominus," says Valentin, as Soon Hua loads an exotic circular weapon on the inside of her left wrist.
Looks plasma-based.
"My team has prepared a secure route. Estimated travel time, 24 minutes.
If Pliny finds out where I'm going, or if the Bologna know, I'm out of the Citadel."
"The lurchers know the situation," Victor says.
"I don't see a gold badge. Mercenaries. Means we are good enough to live this long, Dominus," Valentin says flatly. "We've prepared for all eventualities. Contingency plans and support have been organised."
"How much support?"
"Enough. We're just the transporters, Dominus."
His mouth twitches into a smile, and I take his word for it.
"Bigger problem than the Bologna is third parties thinking an opportunity's just stumble their way. Where we're going, there will be a hell of a lot of third parties, Dominus. Shit complicates our ROI.
Soon what?
Wear this."
Soon Hua tosses me a bag of plain clothing. Her voice drones on in a monotone drawl.
"Your tall can't do shit all about that, but we'll do a quick dye job with this, this and this."
She tosses Victor another bag.
"For you. Boss thought you'd dress too fancy."
Victor laughs at that.
"Muzzles off, boys,"
Valentin barks as the ship trembles and rises in the air.
"We're live."
Thumpers and burners prime in practiced hands. Staccato sound of steel on steel, like metal knuckles cracking as magnetic rounds go into chambers. The lurchers conceal weapons in hidden holsters over tight scarab skin armour. Three wear illegal wrist weapons. I eye the contraband as I slip into my scarab skin. It drinks in the light, a strange pupil-like black. More the absence of colour than anything else. Better than the Duro armour we had at the Institute. It'll stop some blades and the occasional projectile weapon like the common scorcher. The ship shudders as its main engines overtake the vertical thrusters.
"Talon and Minotaur, be advised. Icarus is on the move,"
Valentin rasps into his comm.
"Repeat, Icarus is on the move."
Chapter 7. The Afterbirth. On Luna, there is no dark. No true dark, at least. Lights of a million shades swim together, glossing over the moon's jagged, cracking steel skin of cityscape. snaking public trams and air thoroughfares, flashing communication centres, bustling restaurants and austere police stations, weave into the metal dermis of the city like blood capillaries, nerve endings, sweat glands and hair follicles. We fall away from gold districts, forsaking the high reaches of the city, where stately shuttles and grav boots ferry golds to opera houses atop kilometres-high towers. We dive down past the wealthy silver and copper districts, wending our way through rung paths and aerial trains, through the mid-districts where the yellows, greens, blues and violets reside, past the low district where greys and oranges make their homes. Down and down we go to the gutters of the city, where the roots of this colossal steel jungle burrow into the ground. Myriad low colours ride public transportation from factories to their windowless apartments, some no larger than 1 metre by 3. Only room enough for a bed. Cars rattle out exhaust in clogged beacon-lit boulevards. The deeper we go, the fewer the lights, the dirtier the buildings, the stranger the animals, but the more brilliant the graffiti. I glimpse grey police standing over arrested brown vandals who covered an apartment complex with the image of a hanging girl. My wife. 10 stories tall, hair burning, rendered in digital paint. My chest constricts as we pass, cracking the walls I've built around her memory. I've seen her hanged 1,000 times now, as her martyrdom spreads across the worlds, city by city. Yet each time it strikes me like a physical blow, nerve endings shivering in my chest, heart beating fast, neck tight just under the jaw. How cruel a life, that the sight of my dead wife means hope. No matter our reputations, no enemy would seek us here. No ears to listen, no eyes to see. This is a place of gang killings, robberies, turf battles, drug trade. That my new friend wants such human privacy, privacy not even a jam field can really offer in the Citadel and the High City, means much. It worries me. Means the rules are void. But Victor was right, and Roke was not. Patience will do me nothing. I must take a risk. The team of lurchers has secured an abandoned garage. They provide security for the shuttle while Valentin's team escorts me from the garage into the bustle of the dirty street outside. Refuse and water make bogs out of alleys. Humid air is thick with the sweet musk of rot and the charred soot of burning garbage. Hawkers cry out wares from cracked sidewalks, clogged with reds, browns, greys and oranges of all species. Urchin, invalid, working class, gangers, tweakers, mothers, fathers, beggars, cripples, children. The lost. Io would say this is the hell they've built their heaven upon. And she'd be right. Gazing up, I see more than 0.5 kilometre of tenement buildings before the polluted haze makes a ceiling for the human jungle. Clotheslines and electrical lines crisscross overhead like vines. This sight is hopeless. What is there to change here but everything? We're to meet at the Lost Wee Den. It's a large, tall tavern with a flickering red sign covered in pithy graffiti. 15 levels, all open and looking down on a central drinking hall of tables and booths filled with some 200 customers. I can smell the piss in the metal booths, which sag from use. Bottles rattle and glasses clink as swill is slammed back. Indigo and pink lights flicker on the 15th floor, where they've dancers and private rooms for customers. I pass with Valentin through 2 bouncers with biomod hands. 1 obsidian with skin pale as bleached marble and arms thicker than mine. The other a dark-skinned grey with a scorcher muzzle built into his arm.
The rest of my greys filter in behind me in staggered intervals, some wearing contacts, pretending to be other colours. One even wearing a flesh mask to look pretty as a pink. Can't even tell it's digital till you put a magnet near it. They look like they belong here. I doubt I do, despite the obsidian dye job they've done to me. The sigils on my hands are covered with obsidian prosthetics. My hair is white, eyes black, skin made paler with cosmetics. Victor and I are too large to pass for any other colour. Fortunately, obsidians, though rarer than the other low colours, are not out of place down here. I follow Valentin to a table in an alcove near the back of the hall, where a young man lounges behind a pack of mercenaries and a single obsidian. A deep silence fills me as I watch the obsidian stand and leave the table to sit at an adjacent one. Others eye him too before remembering themselves and looking down at their drinks, like water birds as a crocodile glides past. The obsidian is a foot taller than I, and the whole of his face is tattooed with a skull. Stained. So much for a low profile. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven? I ask the reclining man.
Reaper, even Milton knew Lucifer was a petty son of a bitch.
He smiles enigmatically and waves to the chair across from him.
Do stop towering over me.
He's not even wearing a disguise. I look over at Victor.
Thought it was going to be a new friend. Well, you two have never been friends before. That'd be the new part. You boys have fun now.
You're not staying, I ask.
I showed you the door. You have to walk through it.
She squeezes my butt playfully and sways out. The jackal watches her leave, leaning slightly to get a better view.
Didn't think you cared about women.
I could be dead and I'd still appreciate her. But I don't have to tell you that. Alone in space for months on end, ship all to yourself. Whatever was there to do.
I sit across from him. He offers me a bottle of greenish liquor. I shake my head. I drink to forget about men like you.
Ha! An Arcosian insult, if I'm not mistaken.
One of Lorne's best, though there's enough to choose from. He leans back, enigmatic in his dullness.
Face plain. Eyes like smooth, worn coins.
Hair the colour of desert sand.
Lone hand twirling a silver stylus with the quickness of an insect skittering over blasted ground, crack to crack. The Jackal of Augustus and the Reaper of Mars, together again at long last. How we have fallen.
You chose the venue, I say, as he sets his stylus behind his ear and takes a chicken leg from a platter on the table.
He strips the skin with his teeth. Does it unnerve you?
Why would it? We both know how fond you are of the dark.
He suddenly laughs, a whining, high-pitched bark like a dog being stabbed.
So much pride to you, Darrow, our Andromedus. Family all dead, disgraced, penniless things. So average that your parents didn't even try to introduce you to society. No friends remaining. No one who knew you before you slipped into the Institute. So unassuming-like.
But how you rose when given a chance. Well, at least you still like to talk, I mutter.
And you still like to make enemies.
Everyone has a hobby.
I examine the stump where his right hand should be.
Desperate for attention? You're the only gold alive that wouldn't bother getting a new hand.
I wonder why you provoke me still when your reputation is shattered, your bank accounts emptied.
I shift in my seat.
Oh, yes. You didn't know?
Plinius Thera when he cuts a man's hamstrings.
He emptied all your funds.
So, really, there's very little to you. But here you sit, at the bottom of a moon, alone, with me, with mine, throwing insults.
These are yours, I ask, glancing at the low colours around us. I would have thought they'd disgust you.
Who said you have to like your children? The jackal asks pleasantly. They are a product of our golden loins.
He gnaws on the chicken leg, cracking the bone with his teeth before discarding it.
Do you know what I've been doing with my time?
Wanking off in the bushes.
Alas, no. My defeat at your hand set me back. I'm not afraid to say it.
You hurt me, and my plans. My sister also wounded me.
Gagging me? Binding me naked and throwing me at your feet?
That stung. Especially when all the grand lords and ladies of our fine, peerless caste got a chuckle at my expense. We both know you don't feel pain, Adrius.
Oh, call me the jackal. Hearing Adrius from your lips is like hearing a cat bark.
He shivers, but leans delightedly forward in his seat when a brown woman with thick arms and tattoos, webbing her pale, pockmarked skin, slips from the kitchens carrying three steaming bowls. She sets them before us.
Thank you,
he says, taking two for himself.
I eye the bowl suspiciously. I'm not a poisoner, he says. I could poison my father any time I want, but I don't. Do you know why?
Because you've not gotten what you need out of him.
And that is?
His approval.
The jackal watches me through the steam of his bowl. Quite. I've been offered a great deal of apprenticeships. They offer it to my father's name, not to me. They despise me because I ate students. But it's such hypocrisy. What else was I to do? We're told to win, and I did my best, and then they criticize, act noble as though they didn't commit murder themselves.
Madness.
He shakes his head with a little sigh. Yes, I could have gone to study war at the academy like you. I could have studied politics at the Politico School on Luna. I might have been a decent judiciar if I could stomach Venus.
But I will rise without their hypocrisy, without their schools. I've heard the rumours. Any true?
Most. He pulls more noodles out of the bowl, spreading red pepper sauce over them. I'm a businessman now, Darrow. I buy things. I own things. I create. Of course, I'm seen as a money-grubbing silver by those pretentious, peerless jackasses. But I am not one of the fading lords of 20th-century Europe. I understand there is power in being practical, in owning things, people, ideas, infrastructure. So much more important than money. So much more insidious than... He makes a funny motion with his hand. Spaceships and razors. Tell me, does a ship matter if you can't supply and transport the food to feed its crew? I, above all others, know the importance of food.
You own this place, don't you? I ask.
In a manner. He smiles with too much teeth. I feel I must be blunt with you. We were nearly 18 when we left the Institute. We are now 20. I have been 2 years in exile, and now I wish to return home.
To socialize with peerless jackasses?
I laugh.
If you have been paying attention at all, you'll know I don't have your father's ear.
Paying attention?
He shares a glance with Victra and leans forward.
Reaper, I am the attention. Do you know how much of the communications industry I've acquired?
No.
Good. That means I'm doing it properly. I've acquired more than 20%. With my silent partner, I own nearly 30%.
You're wondering why. Certain families like Victra's do not consider themselves dirtied by business. After all, the Julii have partaken in trade for centuries. But media is different for us. Slimy. Leave that to Quicksilver and his ilk. So why would someone with my lineage dirty his hands with it? Well, I want you to imagine media as a pipeline to a city in the desert. He waves around. Our metaphorical desert. I can provide only 30% of the content of what comes through that pipeline, but I can affect 100% of it. My water contaminates the rest. That is the nature of media. Do I want this city in the desert to hallucinate? Do I want its inhabitants to writhe in pain? Do I want them to rise up? He sets his chopsticks down. It all starts with what I want. And what do you want? I ask. Your head, he says. Our eyes meet like two iron rods colliding, sending stinging reverberations through the body. A palpable discomfort even being near him, much less meeting those dead gold orbs. He's so young, my age, but there's a childishness to him, a curiosity despite the ancient cast of his eyes, that makes him feel like a perversity. It's not that I feel cruelty and evil radiating from him, it's the feeling that crept over me when Mustang told me how, as a boy, he killed a baby lion because he wanted to see its insides to understand how it worked. You have a weird sense of humor. I know, but I'm so glad you get my jokes. So many prickly peerless these days. Duels, honor, blood. All because they're bored. There's no one left to fight. So gory damn tedious. I believe you are making a point.
Ah, yes.
The jackal runs his hand through his slicked back hair, like I've seen his father do. I brought you here because Pliny is an enemy of mine. He's made my life very difficult. Even penetrated my harem. Do you know how many spies of his I've had to kill? I went through so many servants. I'm not trying to make you feel sorry for me, he says quickly. I was on the verge of it. Understanding my plight, however, is how you will help me best. As of now, Pliny controls my father's favor, like a snake hissing in his ear. Leto is his design. Did you know that? I didn't. He found the darling boy, knew he would win my father's cold heart because he would remind father of my dead brother Claudius. So Pliny cultivated him, trained him, and convinced my father to adopt him as a ward, with aims of making him the heir. Then you come waltzing into our lives and disrupt Pliny's plan. It took 2 years to dispatch you, but patiently he did. Just as he did me. Now Leto will be my father's heir, and Pliny will be Leto's master. That hits me hard. I knew Pliny was dangerous. Perhaps I never really knew just how dangerous. So what's your plan? I glance around the room. Going to take back your father's favor with plebeians and pitchforks? As any gold with a decent education would know, there's a certain crime syndicate that runs things in Lost City. A vast criminal enterprise that, if you trace it all the way to the tip-top, is under the influence of the office of the sovereign of our little society. Octavia Auloon may seem the paragon of gold virtue, but she's got a fetish for the dirty stuff. Assassinations, organizing workers' strikes in her own arch-governor's domains, rigging appointments. Her handling of Lost City is no different. She and her furies hand-picked the crime family leadership. These three individuals are her creatures. But here's the juicy kink.
I've found certain members of that same organization who are restless.
I frown. They don't like Loon.
She's an onerous bitch.
One who has spat in my father's eye and cozied up to the Bellona. But no, my champions don't think on that plane. They are low colours, Darrow. They're restless to be atop the shit pile.
Why Lost City? I ask. What does it matter?
It is merely a piece of the puzzle. I'm going to help these ambitious low colours move up, for a price. When they are in power, they are going to kill off a menace that plagues the society. Ares and his sons.
Chapter 8. Scepter and Sword. I go cold inside.
The sons of Ares? I wasn't aware they were so dire a threat.
They're not yet, but they will be, he says. The Sovereign knows it. So does my father, even if it is not in vogue to say it aloud. The Society has faced terrorist cells before. Throw enough lurcher teams at them and they are dispatched easily enough. But the sons are different. They are not a rat biting our heels, but a termite colony slowly gnawing our foundation as quietly as possible till they've done such work that our house crumbles around us. My father has given Pliny the task of eliminating the sons, but Pliny has been failing. He will continue to fail because the sons of Ares are clever, and because my media adores giving them attention. But when they become a thing so dreadful to society, to the Sovereign, to my father, that the very machine of governance grinds to a halt, I will step forward and say, I will cure this disease in 3 weeks. And then I will, with my media, with the syndicate systematically killing all the sons, and with you gloriously beheading Ares himself.
You want a figurehead?
I am not glamorous. I do not inspire.
You are like one of the old conquerors, charismatic and virtuous. When they look at you, they see none of the soft decadence of our meagre time, none of the political poison that has saturated Luna since Loon's family rose to power. They will look at you and see a cleansing knife, a new dawn for a second golden age.
Like father, like son, both targeting the sons of Ares in similar ways. It's chilling, thinking of the war that will rage between crime syndicate throat-cutters and Ares agents. It'll destroy the sons.
The sons of Ares are only the beginning. A leverage point. You want to rule.
What other ambition is there?
But not just Mars.
Just because I'm small doesn't mean my dreams have to be. I want it all. And to get it, I'm willing to do anything.
Even share.
Perhaps you are not aware of what happened 2 months ago. I say, stop a gold anywhere and ask. They'll tell you what the Bellona family did to the Reaper of Mars. I have no reputation. The only thing I inspire is laughter.
Cassius was shamed, the jackal says in irritation. He was pissed on, beaten at the Institute, embarrassed. Now he's the deadliest jeweler on Luna. He fought any that would contest his worth, and now he's the Sovereign's favourite new pet. Did you know the old crow is making him an Olympic knight? Lorne Au Arcus and Venetia Au Rain both retired this year. That means the posts of Rage Knight and Mourning Knight are open.
She'd make him one of the 12.
He is a piece on her board.
The jackal leans forward.
But I tire of playing pawn to my elders.
As do I. Makes me feel like a pink, I say.
Then let us rise together. I the scepter, you the sword.
You won't share. It's not in your nature.
I do what I need to do, no more, no less.
and I need a warlord. I'll be Odysseus, you be Achilles.
Achilles dies in the end.
Then learn from his mistakes.
It's a good idea.
I pause at his spreading smile. With one problem. You are a sociopath, Adrius. You don't only do what you need to do. You wear whatever face you need, whatever emotion you desire, like a glove. How could I ever trust you? You killed Pax.
I let the words hang in the air. You killed my friend, your sister's protector.
Pax and I had never met before. All I saw was an obstacle in my path. Of course, I knew of the Telemanuses, but after Claudius got his brains splattered everywhere, Father split Mustang and me up to protect us, put me in even greater isolation than her. I was his heir. I had no friends, only tutors. He ruined my youth. And then he discarded me as he discarded you, because we lost. You and I mirror each other.
A fight breaks out on the level above us. A scorcher cracks. Bouncers rush upward, cradling their own weapons. Most of the patrons sit undisturbed.
What of your sister?
I ask hesitantly, knowing deep down that I have no other options left but this one.
Do you want to know how she fares? He asks plainly. Who shares her bed? I can give you whatever answers you want. My eyes are everywhere.
I don't want that. I shake my head, trying to banish the dark idea of someone sharing her bed, of her finding joy in someone else, even if she deserves to. Even stranger is thinking the jackal knows these things. Is she involved in this?
No,
the jackal says with a heavy laugh. You know she's with Loon now. It's hilarious, really. Who would have thought that of the two of us, she'd be the prodigal twin? Well, more prodigal.
She cannot be hurt, I say. If she is, I will cut off your head.
That's aggressive. But you have a deal.
So you're with me?
I've been with you since I got into the shuttle. You know I have no other options. And I know no other person who would ever summon me here. The variables could only lead to this end.
And why should they not?
I took his hand. He took a friend. All he has done is bite and claw for his own survival. Watching him now, so small and plain in a world of gods, it's almost as if he's the hero, nobly struggling against a father who rejected him, against a society that laughs at his size, his weakness, and scorns him as a cannibal, even though it was they who told him to do whatever he had to do to win.
In an odd way, he is like me. He could have had his hand repaired, but he chose not to, wearing it as a badge of honor instead of shame. So, I'll go along with this. Then in the end, maybe I'll kill him. For Pax.
His face splits into a grand smile.
I'm so pleased, Dara. So pleased. And, to be honest, a bit relieved.
But what is next? I ask. You must need something from me now.
A gold by the name of Fensor Al Drusilla has learned of my dealings with the syndicates.
He is trying to blackmail me. I need you to kill him.
Of course.
When?
Not for a week or so. The real purpose of killing him will be to gain favour with one of the Sovereign's cousins who was slighted by Fensor. With Fensor's death, you'll fall into the cousin's favour.
I choke down a laugh. You'll have me play the role of a pixie gallant, flitting about court, bedding ladies?
Mustang will think I'm doing it to spite her.
The jackal's eyes sparkle with mischief.
Who said anything about ladies?
Oh, I say, realizing what he means. Oh, that's complicated. Tactus might be better for this. The jackal chuckles at my surprise. Oh, you'll do just fine. But all this is worry for another day. For now, relax. I'll purchase your contract through a second party as soon as it goes up for auction. The Bologna will try to buy it. I have a backer. We'll outspend them. Victra? No. She's more of a broker in this. What you have to understand about Victra is she's not, how do you say, partisan. She just loves stirring the pot. The backer you'll meet soon enough. That won't work, I say. I want to meet him now. I'm not your puppet. I share everything I know. You share everything you know.
But I know so much more.
Fine. He leans forward. You'll meet him tonight. It's not that I don't trust you. I just think it appropriate that he introduces himself. Fine enough. I want to bring the Howlers back, and Severo.
Done. You'll also need to select a blade master, someone to tutor you with the razor. We'll need you to kill a few people publicly in the future.
I know how to use a razor, I say. Not what I've heard. Come now, there's no shame in it. I have a few names.
It's a pity Arcos isn't tutoring.
These days I might actually have the funds to afford Stoneside and his Willow Way.
His words trail off, and his eyes drift from me, pulled to the slinking form of a woman who cuts through the smoke and drab of the tavern like an ember falling through fog. I can smell the almond on her skin, the citrus of her lips as she nears our table, graceful and stirring as the air of Venus's summer coast. Bones fragile, avian. She wears a black shift that covers her skin except her bare shoulders. Then I catch her eyes, and I almost fall out of my chair. It's a shot to the heart. My pulse patters. It's her. The girl with wings who could never fly. But now, she's fled from Mickey, it seems. Wings gone, ripened into womanhood. But why is Evie here? Did the sun send her?
I can barely keep my composure. She hasn't recognized me.
I didn't know roses to grow so deep among the weeds,
the jackal says to her. Her laughter drifts like the beating of a butterfly's wings. She traces the bottom edge of the worn table and shrugs minutely.
Common men can't afford uncommon things. But my mistress heard uncommon men were in Lost City and sent me as an ambassador.
Ah! The jackal leans back, appraising her.
You're a syndicate girl. One of Vabana's?
Off her nod, the jackal looks at me and mistakes my expression of surprise for one of desire.
Take her upstairs, Dara. On me.
A welcoming gift. Let me know if you want to buy her. We can discuss business tomorrow. At the word Darrow, Evie's composure buckles for a blink. She steps back and I hear her breath pattern change. And when her eyes meet mine, I know she sees through the obsidian disguise and glimpses the red underneath all these lies. However, the surprise there means she's not here for me. She's here for the jackal.
But why?
Is she with the Sons, or did Mickey finally sell his prize to this Vabana gangster?
I don't do slaves,
Evie says to the jackal, pointing to my obsidian sigils. You'll find there's more to this one than meets the eye.
Dominus, I...
He grabs her hand, twisting her pinky horribly.
Shut up. And do as you're told, girl, or we'll take what you won't give.
He flashes a great smile and releases her. She holds her hand, trembling. It doesn't take much to wound a pink. I stand. I believe I'll take it from here, my friend. I'm sure you will. I wave the bodyguards away who try to accompany me. I follow Evie up the hand rungs leading to the fourth floor, earning hoots from some of the patrons. My eyes catch one of the holocans above the bar. Images of a bombing ripple in three dimensions. It looks to be at a cafe. A gold cafe. My eyes widen as the extent of the devastation is shown. Was it the Sun's? Another bombing flashes across a different screen. And another. And another till dozens of bombings flood the screens throughout the tavern. All heads turn to watch, silence yawning through the vast tavern. Evie's hand tightens around mine, and I know it was the Sun's who committed the bombings. They sent her. But why Luna? Why the Jackal? Why haven't they contacted me? Hurry, she says, as we reach the 15th floor, pulling me through the pink lights, past the dancers and hungry patrons, to the last door at the end of a narrow corridor. I follow her inside the dark room and immediately smell the acrid tang of scorcher oil. Air shifts behind me as a man in a ghost cloak creeps forward. It takes considerable effort to resist the impulse to kill him.
He's one of ours, Evie snaps.
She turns on the light. Six Reds in heavy military tech decloak. They wear demon helms with high-grade optics.
Call in the Skimmer.
He's not Aegis, our Augustus,
one of them growls.
He's a bloody obsidian.
Strange-looking one. One of the Reds with the optics jumps back. Scorcher priming.
Bone density is gold.
Stop, Evie shouts. He's a friend. Harmony has been looking for him.
Not Ares or Dancer.
You weren't here for me, I say, eyeing their weapons. You were hunting.
She turns to me.
I'll explain later, but we have to go.
What did you do?
I ask, as one of the Reds pulls out a plasma torch and cuts a hole in the wall, opening the room up to the stink of the city. Moist air rushes in, and lights flood the room as a small dropship descends, opening its side hatches parallel to the improvised door.
Darrow, there's no time.
I grab her.
Evie, why are you here?
Her eyes flash with triumph.
Adrius, our Augustus, has murdered 15 of our brothers and sisters. I was sent to capture or kill him. I chose the latter. In 20 seconds he'll be ash.
I rip one of the Red's datapads off his arm and prime my concealed grav boots. Evie shouts at me. The boots whine mournfully as they lift me into the air. I rip back the way we came, rupturing through the door instead of opening it, flying down the hallway like a bat out of hell. I smash past a dancer, careen over two orange customers, and turn a razor-tight right angle down over the railing toward the Jackal's table as he finishes his liquor. His stained marks me, as do the Greys. Too slow. On the screens, over the bombings, the static crackles, and a blood-red helm burns.
Reap what you sow.
Ares' voice growls from a dozen speakers. The table melts under the Jackal's hand, consumed by the bomb Evie planted. The stain throws the Jackal away from the table like a doll and curls his titanic body around the mushrooming energy. His mouth moves in a death whisper.
Skirnir al Falnir.